Barfield. I am a local Tacoma cannabis writer, reporter, and activist. And I am joined by my co-host, who is a Oregon medical cannabis activist and grower and veteran, Uncle Dig. How you doing today, Uncle Dig?
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day outside, and my plants are doing well.
Yeah, it is a kind of great time of year, but a little chilly, so winter is moving on past us. But we do have a great show today. But before we get into the show, I want to remind the audience about our interaction we're having with the audience. If you would like to, you can send in your first time getting high stories to us, and we will read those on the air, or you can record them on your phone or your computer and send them in, and we will play them on the air. Now, we know that cannabis could be a problem with your workplace or out there in the community, so you can be totally anonymous and send this in to us. Where do they send these in to, Dig?
Yeah, you can send them to my Gmail at uncledig4@gmail.com, or you can contact me on Instagram at uncledig.
Yeah, and if you send in 5 of those stories, Dig will tell his first time getting high story on the air. And if you send in 10, I'll tell my first time getting high story on the air. And my first time getting high story involves a 3-foot red bong, a crack smoking police officer, a defunct social studies teacher, and Alabama death row. So quite a story there behind my first time getting high story. So send in your first time getting high stories, and we will read them on the air. 5, Dig will tell his story on the air, and 10, I will tell my story on the air. We are looking forward to hearing those responses. Yeah, we have a great show for you coming up. We have an interview with someone who's going to come and talk to us about tie sticks, a guy named Rick Barbero. And I kind of want to set up the interview before we get to it, because it involves a story about when I first started using cannabis. Sorry, not my first time using cannabis. Send in 10 of those first time getting high stories, and I will tell my first time getting high story on the air. But this is kind of around that same time. We used to go out and hang out with a friend of mine's brother, and he would always tell us stories about tie sticks. He was from the Bronx. He was always telling us about these tie sticks. And us little Alabama guys were always looking at him going, oh, wow, tie sticks, Bronx. It was kind of interesting. At the same time, it was just kind of like, okay, yeah, right, buddy. But then over the years, I still never saw a tie stick, Dig. Have you ever actually seen a real tie stick?
I never have. I think they were a bit before my time.
Yeah, and I never have seen one either. And then recently, I've gotten into rolling these Canagars, and then someone said, oh, that's like a tie stick. So I was, okay. And then I've been seeing people post around on social media about, oh, well, everybody remember those tie sticks, and people were posting about them and everything. So I put on social media, hey, I want to talk to somebody about a tie stick, just because I was actually just interested in talking about somebody who had used them or had some back in the day. But turns out a guy named Matthew Friedlander, owner of Skagit Organics here in Washington State, tagged Rick Barbero and said, hey, have Rick on the show. He can talk to you about tie sticks. And turns out Rick was the guy smuggling these into the United States. And we're going to have him on the show later, Dig.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good interview. I look forward to it.
All right, so let's get into the news. And we're not going over to Thailand just yet. We're going to start in Georgia, over in the southeast United States. And there's a real interesting situation setting up in Georgia. They have this strange runoff situation in their Senate race. So they have 2 Republicans running against 2 Democrats. And sort of the word is out there that this could sway how the United States Senate looks at cannabis legalization goes forward. Because remember, the MORE Act just passed, and then there's a Senate bill, the Marijuana Justice Act, that is in the Senate as well. So it kind of depends, and we have a Democratic president, Joe Biden, and so it kind of depends on which way the Senate goes on cannabis legalization. Give us some details about those Georgia races, Dick.
Yeah, the first Georgia race is between Senator Kelly Loeffler, a Republican, and Democrat Reverend Raphael Warnock, who's a Democrat. And, of course, Senator Kelly Loeffler is anti-cannabis. She's made several statements that she doesn't want to legalize cannabis, even medically. And the Democratic candidate, Reverend Raphael Warnock, is pro-cannabis, pro-medical, pro-recreational, and he wants to include social equity measures in any upcoming Senate cannabis bills. And that's the first race. The second race is a little less divisive as far as cannabis is concerned. The Republican, Senator David Perdue, says he is pro-medical. He doesn't really feel comfortable, I think was the wording he used, about recreational cannabis yet. But I think as far as Republican politicians, he might be able to be persuaded by his constituency. However, his Democratic opponent, John Ossoff, is pro-cannabis and has made several statements in support of social equity programs as well.
Yeah, so interesting races setting up there in Georgia. But as we've spoken about before on this show, just because the Democrats might control the Senate does not mean that necessarily cannabis legalization might happen. Kind of the thing is, the thinking is that probably it's going to be a little more piecemeal legislation, things like cannabis banking, cannabis. But I think they're going to be trying to leave it up to the states a lot. So we'll see what happens going forward.
Yeah, we will.
All right, so next up, we are going to stay in the South, and that is Mississippi. Now, Mississippi did a historic move and legalized medical cannabis back on the election on November 3rd. And it was a big landslide of an election, and they legalized medical cannabis. But there was a local mayor who filed a lawsuit right before the election and tried to stop the ballot, tried to stop the measure because of the ballot language. But then that was overturned, and of course, the election just went ahead. And now she has come back with a new lawsuit, Dig.
Yeah, and the new lawsuit is against the state's Initiative 65 of cannabis legalization because it limits the city's ability to regulate the location of medical marijuana businesses. And basically, what this is a lot of times in places where cannabis is legalized, local ordinances are passed against different aspects of the legalization to limit access and limit cannabis being visible within certain towns.
Yeah, and that is happening all around the country. California, even one of the biggest cannabis markets in the world, has this issue. Arizona, Washington even has it. And they're kicking this out to the Supreme Court. I predict that the Mississippi Supreme Court is going to side with the people on this and not overturn the initiative just because it was such a big landslide. And we'll see going forward what happens with Mississippi.
Yeah, we will. We will. And it's very rare for the courts to overturn like large majorities like this. But we have seen it in the past. We all need to remember Florida, who passed an initiative by a hefty margin. But because of their majority laws and such, even though it was close to 70%, they still didn't get their first go around cannabis stuff passed.
Yeah, and that actually happened in Nebraska recently, too. They overturned it, and Nebraska's tried to start again a medical cannabis initiative, but they just had theirs thrown out too. So the Supreme Courts can be a little heavy-handed when it comes to initiatives. So let's not hope that doesn't happen in Mississippi. Next, we're going to go out to the federal level, and we're going to talk about a bill that Rand Paul just introduced, and it is called, strangely enough, HEMP. And it is the Hemp Economic Mobilization Plan. A really clever name there from the senator from Kentucky. And this bill does a couple different things, but one of the big things it does is it raises the THC level from 0.3% up to 1% as far as the definition of a cannabis plant that can be labeled as hemp.
Yeah, it's really interesting what they've done here. Part of the challenges of modern hemp breeding has been this like ultra, ultra low THC content that's below the threshold that's needed to get high. In fact, I think 1% might be getting closer to that, but still very, very negligible. And I think the other thing that's interesting about this is this: there's a provision in this bill to give papers that verify something as a low THC hemp, so that if a trucker with a load of processed hemp gets stopped by the police, they have paperwork to show that they don't in fact have cannabis, and we can limit some of this confusion that law enforcement has been feeling about federal law.
Yeah, because they're stopping big loads of hemp, and then wherever those things are getting stopped, at the other end is somebody wanting to process that into some type of CBD product. So that's actually slowing down the CBD market, which we need the CBD on the market. As we know, it's a very potent medicinal product out there right now. One of the interesting things I find about this is, one, there's two sides of this. One side is, yes, let's open it up to 1%. And then the other side is, oh, well, we've put all this money into breeding the hemp plant to get it down to 0.3%. And all the extractors are set to have it to 0.3%. And it really seems to me that that's just an argument for limiting the ability for just regular people or just regular farmers to get into the hemp business. And as we know, this all dates back to the Marijuana Tax Act, getting all the black hemp farmers out of the business. And then I want to get rid of this 0.3% because that is actually from the Controlled Substances Act. So anything we can do to get rid of that language, I think is a good thing.
Well, and that language was based on a few fallacies, and it was mainly an attempt to eliminate most forms of cannabis and hemp from the American landscape. That's why they took the threshold so low. It's very hard to breed plants that produce that little THC. So they, like you said, they cut people out of the market because they weren't able to do these stabilized breeding programs where you require like so many different like generations of breeding to stabilize these genes. So they produce this ultra low THC content. It's very expensive and it's space prohibitive too.
All right, next time we're going to move on to Colombia. And in Colombia, they are getting set up to export high THC cannabis. And I know we've mentioned on this show before that Colombia exports high THC cannabis, and that actually is only for scientific purposes right now. So I wanted to correct that really quick. But they are sort of leaning in the direction of exporting more high THC cannabis. The Superintendency of Industry and Commerce wrote a letter to the Ministry of Health saying, hey, we need to open this up more. And, you know, it's just kind of a no-brainer that Colombia would export high THC cannabis, in my opinion.
Yeah. Traditionally, I think they've been known as a bit of a narco state. So to be able to set up a more legalized infrastructure around cannabis eventually and to maybe be a lead exporter, that would be, I think, be good for their economy. They've got the climate for it down there in a lot of ways. And they may be able to outcompete some sluggish behemoths that are going to be late to the game, like the U.S. and some other countries that have really developed agricultural markets that could really take advantage of an early international cannabis market, but are unable to seize the initiative due to unimaginative governments.
Yeah, and Uruguay is actually leading the way, and they mentioned that in the Colombian article about how, you know, Uruguay is an example of this actually working in South America, and Australia exports medical cannabis, and Canada is doing it as well. So, yeah, the United States is really playing catch up on the international cannabis market right now.
Yeah, and it's a shame because we have some of the best terroir and the best cannabis in the world. We grow some of the best cannabis in the world in the United States, and it's a shame that we can't share this product with the rest of the world.
So speaking of the rest of the world and the international cannabis market, we're going to get on into our interview. Yeah, hey, and Dig and I are back with this week's interview. And this week, we are happy to welcome Rick Barbero. Rick is an ex-cannabis smuggler, cannabis entrepreneur, and author who wrote a book called 90 Degrees to Zamboanga. That's Zamboanga. And he is going to be here today talking to us about tie sticks. How are you doing today, Rick?
Well, thank you very much. That was a great intro, and let's go. I'm ready for your questions.
All right. Thanks for joining us today, Rick. And I just wanted to start off and say, in your book, you talked about how at first you were running cannabis up and down the California-Mexico coast, and then you decided to go over to Thailand. What right. actually got you over to Thailand at first? Tell us about that first trip you took over with your friend Pat.
Well, first of all, I was no newcomer to the marijuana business. I grew up in San Francisco in the 60s. So the summer of love and everything, I was totally into that. Towards the end of the 60s, I was a college student, you know, was into selling marijuana. And a friend of mine got me into actually smuggling marijuana. And So that would happen in this in the late 60s. And so it transitioned to sailboats and from just walking it across to sailboats. And after a while, a few years into it, I was about 4 years into it, I guess, a friend of mine I had met through who was working for another smuggling group I met, he was a Thai exchange student. And he got into a argument with the people he was working with and quit and wanted to go back home to Thailand. And I was friends with him, and he invited me to come over there in 1973. And I went, and we traveled all over Southeast Asia up into Nepal and checked out various operations that we might want to be into. And since he was from Thailand, it was kind of a no-brainer that we decided to, you know, try to smuggle Thai weed, which I had seen very sparingly back in San Francisco. So, you know, it was the start of a new adventure. And Pat and I went over there. We traveled around, and it took us about a year and a half of planning. And we risk analysis, logistics, kind of worked it all out and put it all together. That's how it all started.
Yeah, it's quite an incredible story. And in your book, you talk about that you took a boat and you outfitted it. And talk about that boat real quick and why you named it what you did and what you did to that boat to get it ready for your first trip.
Okay. So, we, you know, in preparation for this trip, we felt we needed our own transportation. So the captain and I searched all of California, Northern California and Southern California for a boat that might work for this venture. And we found in Southern California, we exhausted everything in Northern California. We found a boat in Southern California that was a 41-foot fiberglass racing sailboat. And we raced sailboats to Mexico and smuggled back from those racing trips. So this was a boat that had been campaigned, but was older. So we converted that boat into an ocean crossing boat. We changed the rigging, changed the sail configuration, but we also reconstructed the inside of that boat to create hidden spaces where we could conceal a ton of weed on that boat, and we could invite people on it and nobody would be able to see it. We would seal it into the hull of the boat, basically. And we calculated it out, and we could conceal a ton. The name of it was very interesting because we bought that boat. It already had a name, and that name was Nepenthe, which coincidentally was the name of a drug that was used back in ancient Grecian times. It was written about. It's been written about in the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's also been written about in Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. So it's got a history. The first trip, we contemplated this first trip, and I was going to actually sail over and back on this boat. You know, I wanted to do it. I wanted to experience an ocean sailing, an ocean crossing. So I volunteered as one of the four crew members. The trip over and back was an amazing experience. It was a very harrowing experience. Just briefly, I mean, we got caught in a typhoon. It was right during the Vietnam War. We had to be careful of that. We stopped in Cambodia when they were doing the secret bombing of Cambodia. There were pirates. We got approached by, we were nearly run over by a tramp steamer. And we had months of bad weather and huge seas, and we nearly ran out of food and water. It was an amazing experience, and it's all detailed in the book.
That sounds pretty harrowing. I know that anytime you're dealing with a sailboat as opposed to any kind of powered ship, it can make it even more dangerous. I wanted to ask you, because, you know, not everyone might know, what exactly is a Thai stick and what made it special?
Okay, well, originally, I mean, the meaning of it has kind of changed over time. But originally, back in the early 70s, it was simply very potent cannabis that was grown in Thailand. And it was cured. After it was cured, each bud was manicured very similar to what they do now, but it would, but they would take each manicured bud off of the stem and affix it to about a 6-inch, very thin bamboo stick. So you would get a bunch of these buds attached to the stick, wrapped around the stick and attached with a piece of very fine, hemp thread, that was wound around it. And that created a tie stick. That was what a tie stick was. It was really weed grown in Thailand that was affixed to a stick.
So it's not a, it's not, you don't smoke the stick. You take the bud off the stick and smoke it.
Correct. You, yeah, okay. You just unwrap the twine slowly as you're preparing it, and each bud will become separated from the stick. There's a certain stickiness to it, so it attaches, it affixes itself. So as you unwrap that twine, that thread, the bud, you take the buds off and you prepare it just the way you would. That's what a tie stick is.
Okay. And see, I was under the impression, and I kind of thought they were basically buds tied to a skewer, but other, like, kind of like you described, I know there's more to it than that, but basically it's a way of packaging it, not a, a Kanagar like preparation, at least not.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It was really, I think, a way to transport it, to make a convenient way to transport it rather than the loose pack or brick, form that we were used to. They actually took the buds and made them very presentable and made it in a uniform, shape that made it easy to stack and easy to, much easier to transport than just a, you know, bag of loose buds.
That's very informative. Thank you.
After it's cured, it's a painstaking effort, involving the entire village, participation. And each family, after it's cured, then each family is given like a garbage can, several garbage can bags full of buds that are full of buds that are still on the stems. They have to manicure them, take them off, and prepare the sticks. And I mean, just to give you an idea, they would make these sticks. Each stick is about 6 inches long, probably about the circumference of a, maybe from a nickel to a quarter. Each stick, there were 20 sticks laid in two rows, stacked one on top of the other, which created a 20 stick bundle. So each stick weighed about 15 grams. There were 20 sticks to a bundle, so that's about 300 grams per bundle. There were four bundles to a package. We packaged them that way. So each package was roughly a kilo or a little bit more than a kilo.
Okay.
And there were 30 packages to a bale. So that, and each bale was about 50 pounds, and there's 40 bales to a ton. So that's kind of the mathematics of the operation. And, you know, we did multiple ton loads at various times.
So tell us about when you went up to the village and that you saw that Christmas tree farm, as you described it. Tell us about the plants and your sort of your first impressions of the actual cannabis flower and what they look like. I remember in the book you said that you wanted them just to send you the green and gold flower. So tell us a little bit about the smell and taste and the look of these plants there in Thailand.
So we arrived at this village. All the buildings are up on stilts. You know, it floods during the monsoon season. So there's like a longhouse, which is like a meeting gathering area where all the individuals meet and discuss whatever village issues there are. And so we met the village elders and the sons in the longhouse. And it was there where we, you know, had our initial meetings, and we were able to develop our standards with the people. And they understood we wanted the quality. We wanted the green and gold. We wanted the freshest, the best quality we could get. And they understood that, and they accepted that. We were very unique in that very few Westerners were able to even visit these villages. I was very fortunate that I was able to. And so when I arrived there and we discussed things with the elders, then we asked their sons to take us out and show us the farm. which we kind of walked out through this. It was kind of a jungle step area. It wasn't total jungle, but it was kind of jungly. And we went out maybe a mile from the village to the grow area. And it blew my mind. It was several acres of plants, rows upon rows of plants, just at the peak of maturation. I mean, the buds were just glistening in the sun with resin, 10 feet tall plants. The smell was outrageous. It just knocked you over. And Thai wheat has a very characteristic smell. I never smelled anything like it. It was, it's very resinous. It's very pungent. It's got a sweet, kind of a unique characteristic.
So you
just sweet, pungent, heavenly, sticky. You know, I rolled a joint out in the field. I broke off a top and rolled a joint. It wasn't even cured. And you could one hit, you try to get one hit. It was so resinous. You could get one hit and would go out and you'd have to relight it. So that's what it was like. My first impression, my mind was completely blown when I first saw it.
Wow. So you brought back that first load. In the book, you take it to your friend, he takes his knife and he cuts it open. And that smell comes out. And so how were these received over here in the United States?
That was my distributor, Yorktown Billy, who was he was from New York. We were in California. So he was from New York. He had a New York accent. He looked like sounded like a person from New York who you would associate that with. It was stunned disbelief, just silence. As I brought that package in and he cut it open with a knife and had been inert for the past 4 months inside of that package. And the smell, it was voluminous, both in it just expanded and the smell just permeated the room. And it was an unbelievable experience right at that moment. But it was, I mean, the weed was four times as expensive as what we brought from Mexico. And it was gorgeous. And I was very curious as to how it would be received. And, you know, at first the public was very reluctant. It was expensive. It was like $1,600 a pound, where before the most we'd ever gotten for anything from Mexico was $400 or $500 a pound. But it was beautiful, and it was very slow at first, and I was really worried: are we even going to be able to sell this? And what's going on? Once it kind of took hold, though, it flew out the door, and it was like, oh my God! You know, the American smoking public wasn't ready for it. And they were just clamoring for more, you know, and it was like it just opened up a whole new world of what was going on.
The way you describe coming out to the back of that village when you describe seeing the plants for the first time is kind of the same experience I had rolling through the fields outside Kandahar when I did time in Afghanistan. And I wasn't even a weed person yet. There's something about seeing a large outdoor cannabis plant for the first time that's just really, really special.
Yeah, it is something that, you know, and I've seen a lot of indoor grows, and it's beautiful, but there's nothing like seeing acres of an outdoor grow. I mean, just glistening in the sun, just the beauty, the resin, just the sparkle. It's just something, if you're a person who's into it, it's something you can't explain, and the experience is unbelievable.
So you were bringing this stuff over and your packaging evolved over time. And it sounds like you were kind of way ahead of your time with the Mylar bags. Could you tell us a little bit how you came to that?
Necessity is the mother of invention. In Mexico, we loaded a boat with about a ton, and we loaded it through heavy surf and lost about 400 pounds. Didn't lose it, but it got wet. About 400 pounds that we ended up bringing up and drying. And we did not want to go through that again, especially with a trip from this far away that was going to be this involved. So the first trip over there, we wanted to make sure that nothing would get wet if that happened. And we doubled and triple bagged. We've used a vacuum cleaner to vacuum seal it with an iron to seal the bags, and doubled and triple bagged it with regular plastic bags and gray tape. And That was on the first trip, and nothing got wet. But on the second trip, we decided that we wanted to really streamline the whole thing. So we found a source in the Bay Area that sold vacuum sealing machines. And they were large machines that weighed a couple hundred pounds each one. And they also advised us that not to use regular plastic bags, because over time they would leak and, you know, your seal would disintegrate. And they introduced us to oxygen moisture barrier bags, which were made of Mylar. They were clear, whereas the plastic bags were kind of not a clear, you couldn't see right into them. They were kind of murky. So this created a whole new packaging idea for us. And with the vacuum sealing machines, we were able to basically start a production line where we had conveyor belts and men who would package, and the production line would go through the ceiling and come off the other side, and then we would put them in bales. So that created an entire production line. But the bags were really the key, because nothing leaked. It created an inert, the weed was inert for that whole time. And when you open it up, it was like it was totally fresh coming out. Now, these bags were subsequently used in the computer industry, where all your computer chips were sealed in Mylar bags. And we kind of pioneered that, as well as where the weed is, how the weed is packaged today in Mylar bags. We started it.
And, yeah. What this is year how it was happened. That?
This was 1975.
So, and it sounds like around 74, 75, your operation's getting a little bigger. You've got these assembly lines and stuff. What challenges did that bring you, especially unexpected challenges?
Well, my intention was always to keep our operation small, grassroots, a few people, a few trusted people. And, you know, I felt we could operate that way for years. We didn't need a huge operation. Well, as time went on, after we did our third load from Thailand on Nepenthe, other people got wind of it. Other smugglers who had been smuggling to Morocco and Afghanistan and Mexico, they got wind of what we were doing and wanted in. And I didn't want to let anybody else in, but I got voted out. I mean, it was the greed or whatever. I wanted to keep the operation small, and I got outvoted, and ultimately that was our downfall, is letting other people in. And that was unexpected for me, because I just was pretty adamant, but, you know, just got led along by the other members of my group.
So the operation gets bigger and bigger, and I kind of want to fast forward to something that was brought to my attention on Facebook. Another person I know who lives up in Port Angeles said, well, hey, right about this time we had a big, massive dump of tie sticks, and a whole bunch of people in Port Angeles ended up with garages full of tie sticks, and I had some, and it was this whole big thing in Port Angeles, and ended up you were involved in that with some way. So tell us a little bit about that operation.
I actually retired in 1977. From the business. It got crazy, and we just felt it was kind of dangerous to continue on. We'd been successful and get out while the getting was good, I suppose. Anyway, in 79, let me backtrack a little bit. We'd loaded several boats in 77. Amongst them was a boat that was owned by a group from Southern California. They were called the Coronado Company. And after we retired, they did put together a couple of loads, but the quality was very inferior, and they, you know, felt that they couldn't continue doing this if they couldn't get the good quality that they'd gotten when we loaded them. So they contacted Pat, and Pat contacted me, and they wanted to do another trip, and it was going to be a very large load. They were proposing a 10-ton load, and they were going to offload it on the Olympic Peninsula with the assistance of the Washington National Guard, who they'd contracted with several of their pilots. And they were going to use these helicopters to offload this load, this large load. Well, we went with it, And we loaded, we ended up loading a 7-ton load. And for one reason or another, they got a little bit delayed. They were supposed to leave in April. They didn't leave. They didn't load till June. Took about a month or 6 weeks for them to get over. And they, when they arrived on the Washington Peninsula, ready for the offloading, it was engulfed in fog, which was pea soup fog right down to the water. The helicopters couldn't make contact with the boat. And they tried for 3 days. They almost dropped a helicopter in the water trying to do it blindfolded. Well, they couldn't do it. And the boat crew panicked. And, you know, they'd been going in and out of international waters for 3 days, bringing the load up on deck to put it in these cages for the helicopters to pick it up. And they in and out. They couldn't complete it. So the boat crew panicked and said they were going to throw the load overboard unless they got it off right away. And the weather was terrible up there. But some of the organizers met with the Macaw Indians up at Nia Bay, and they agreed to assist in the offloading at Nia Bay in their harbor. Well, the night of the offloading was a terrible weather, and the load got caught in a riptide, and we lost about 250 out of about 330 we lost. Wow. Anyway, it wound up in this is on the Straits of Juan de Fuca, which is right at the northern end of the state of Washington, between Washington and Canada. The people in Port Angeles, which is about 60 miles away, would have had bales washing up on their beach probably in the next couple of days. So it was no surprise that happened. And, you know, that we lost that load, and it really was ultimately what brought us down. That's what happened. And that's how the people in Port Angeles would have gotten that load, would have gotten some of that load.
Wow. Yeah, so this all did end up catching up with you, and you did serve a little bit of time. Talk about that, and talk about now writing your book.
Basically, the members of the Coronado Company, when the issue hit the fan, they rolled over. The head of the whole operation rolled over on everybody else. He rolled over on me specifically, and told the DEA about me and my operation. And of course, they chased me . And I got indicted. I never got caught with anything. I got indicted, got convicted. My conviction got overturned, and I was able to negotiate much better. They gave me 7 years to start with. I ended up serving two. But interestingly, I found the agents who chased me, both the IRS and the DEA agent who chased me, and I interviewed them for my book. And they were very supportive, very cooperative. They loved the fact what I had written. And they were just very cool, very supportive about the whole thing. So I thought that was really an interesting part of it, and I included it in my book.
We're sorry that you had to serve time for the plant.
Well, you know, I mean, it happened. There's still people who are serving time now. It's a shame. You know, people are doing a lot to try to correct that, and I think it will be corrected.
I think it will be, but not fast enough. I wanted to ask you a happier question. You know, what kind of cannabis do you currently consume? And also, if we wanted to chase that old tie stick high in the current legal market, where would we go looking for that?
You know, I've never been able to duplicate it, so I really don't know. But Thailand now is legalizing marijuana. So, I mean, I think it's only a matter of time before the actual tie sticks will make it over here, because they are in the process of a complete renaissance and reawakening in Thailand right now. So I think that is happening, and I think that will continue to happen.
All right, Rick. Thanks for the great information there, and we really appreciate you coming and doing this interview with us. So before we get out of here, let us know a little bit more about your book and where people can find it and any other information you might want to leave us with.
You know, my book, the name of it, it's 90 Degrees to Zamboanga, Memoirs of a 20-Year Marijuana Smuggling Adventure, and it's available on Amazon. It's in paperback and on Kindle. One of my projects for this coming year is going to be to do an audio book. You know, I know some people that don't particularly read and would really enjoy that. So that's one of the things that I'm planning for in the coming year. I wrote this book, you know, in the first person, and I wrote it like a novel because I wanted it to be really readable. I'd read a lot of other books and indictments, and I did a lot of research on this, and I felt that it, if it was going to be readable, it needed to be done in the first person in real time, bring the reader into it, make the reader a fly on the wall to what was going on, to the conversations and everything. So I wrote it in real time and firsthand, you know, to give the reader firsthand experience. You know, we've developed in the last 2 years, we've developed a website and social media to promote it. You know, it's on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I have a website, 90tozambo.com is the website. None of this would be possible without my website designer and the gal who designed my book cover, Lauren Taylor, ltdesignco.com, kindgoodcompany.com is her company. And I mean, she's wonderful. She's made this whole thing happen for me. I just can't thank her enough. It's 90tozambo.com is the website.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us, Rick.
Yeah, thanks,
you know, Rick. I really appreciate the opportunity. You know, it's, we're trying to get it out there. We always thought, even way back in the day when we were actually working and doing this, we thought, boy, this would make a great movie. I contemplated that for years and years. And that's really the direction of this project. I mean, someday, somehow, there's been I've gotten a lot of reviews. People are talking about it. People are saying that it should be maybe a Netflix series, something like that. So that's the direction. And, you know, just keep positive thoughts, keep, you know, think good thoughts. That was one of my mottos. And that's what we're doing. We're real positive about this. And, you know, I'm so happy and thankful for this opportunity, Lucas.
Really want to thank Rick one more time for being on the show. Don't forget to go check him out over at 90tozambo.com. But now we're going to get into our final segment of the show. It's our It's a Bus segment. This takes us over to the East Coast and to what they call the smallest state of the Union, Rhode Island. But they didn't have the smallest drug busts over there. They did four large busts in one little town. And tell us about those busts, Dig.
Oh, yeah. So in Warwick, Rhode Island, a marijuana grow pulled by federal and local officers is allegedly related to a 2019 seizure in West Warwick. Hundreds of marijuana plants were confiscated Friday from address, a location that up to 2 years ago housed a community organization. Then later, in another plant, they seized dozens of plants from a different address. And then further along in the article, on Saturday, police confiscated 657 cannabis plants and 19 pounds of processed cannabis. And on a different street, on Sunday, they confiscated 474 marijuana plants and more than 31 pounds of processed cannabis. So it seems like Warwick is a bit of a cannabis cultivation hub on the East Coast.
Yeah, and I'm hoping this is not a crackdown because New Jersey just legalized cannabis, and you have all these other cannabis legalized states around there. And I believe, you know, we saw some of the same kind of thing going over here on the West Coast on Humboldt County. They're always trying to, like, crack down on the underground market.
Oh, yeah.
And we really hope that that is not the case. And I think Rick's story presents us facts telling us that we cannot arrest our way or get our way out of this by just arresting and chasing people down, because it is a plant and people are going to grow it wherever they can.
You know, I'm hesitant when people compare cannabis to alcohol in any way, but I think what we saw happen in Appalachia and around the South when in regards to alcohol taxes and how people tried to get around those, I think that for a certain segment of the United States population or a certain segment of any population, some people are going to, for lack of a better word, bootleg no matter what you do. So it's how we try to bring those people into the legal market in a least coercive way as possible will kind of define how the industry develops in the future.
All right. Great point. And so we are going to get out of here. Thank you for joining the Cannabis Corner. Don't forget to send in your first time getting high stories to the show, and we will get those on the air. And I just want to thank real quick, the fantastic Flying Folsch has been producing this show over the past season. And I wanted to mention that. Thank you so much to them for producing this show for us. And I want to thank Rick for coming on the show. And how can people send in those first time getting high stories and get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can send me an email, UncleDig4@gmail.com. You can also contact me on Instagram, @UncleDig.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH Radio Tacoma.